The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 30th, 2017, special edition, Indictment Day. It was a big day today in Washington. An indictment came down against Paul Manafort and Richard Gates, and a surprise plea deal involving George Papadopoulos emerged out of nowhere. We gathered the gang on a conference call. Bob Bauer, former White House counsel under President Obama, and Paul Rosenzweig, former DHS official, and more importantly for present purposes, a prosecutor under independent counsel Kenneth Starr. We talked about the indictments. We talk about what comes next. We avoided irresponsible speculation. It's the Lawfare Podcast, special edition, Indictment Day. Paul, get us started. You've been a federal prosecutor in a high-profile investigation of the president. What is your read on this? What happened today?
Well, it was a good day for the special counsel. It was probably not a very good day for Mr. Manafort or Mr. Gates. Atmospherically, it was not a good day for the president, but that's kind of less law and more policy. I would say that the best way to characterize what happened today is it's the end of the beginning. We're now in something like the bottom of the second inning of the baseball game, and all of a sudden, somebody's put a couple of runs on the board.
But I want to flesh that out a little bit. When you say the end of the beginning, I mean, I was expecting today a fairly dramatic indictment of Manafort on grounds that there had been a no-knock warrant. So we weren't talking about just a normal old white-collar criminal case. On the other hand, I certainly was not expecting an indictment involving a sum of money like $75 million. I was not expecting the degree of forensic detail that is evident in this indictment, which, you know, is pretty awesome in terms of the number of wire transfers that they're talking about. And I certainly wasn't expecting a fully blown plea deal from a campaign volunteer who is purporting to be right in the middle of a collusion enterprise between the Russians and the Trump campaign. And so I look at this as a kind of shock and awe first inning, if you want to describe it as the end of the first inning. And I'm interested in your thoughts on whether that's overreading it.
I always am reluctant to get too far ahead in these things. It certainly was a powerful display, particularly as you said, the details in the Manafort indictment reflect an immensely large amount of forensic work that has already gone on, which is sort of why I characterize it as the end of the beginning. The beginning is all the stuff that happens behind the scenes before the very first public exposure of the nature and extent of the investigation. That's sort of what I meant. The Manafort indictment, both in its scale in terms of the gross amount of criminality and in its depth of detail, reflects an organization that has put a significant amount of effort into examining the criminality at issue. And frankly, if any portion of that is true, I would not want to be trying this in front of a D.C. jury in particular, who is not going to look very fondly on taking Ukrainian money to buy custom-made suits at men's clothing stores. But with all that said about the Manafort indictment, it isn't really about the Russia collusion piece of the puzzle that is at the heart of why the special counsel was appointed. So what was really surprising with the day was the unsealing of the Papadopoulos plea agreement, which, fairly characterized is a Trump campaign advisor soliciting information from people he believes to be Russian officials. Indeed, he thinks one of them is the niece of Vladimir Putin, wrongly, but that's what he thinks, for use in the campaign, which pretty much defines the concept of collusion. So now that aspect of the investigation takes on an air of reality. And if you read the Papadopoulos information closely, there are at least two other Trump officials who are in his sights as having been aware of, if not active participants in, Papadopoulos's approach to the Russians. And therefore, the scope of that investigation now looks like it's about to expand asymptotically.
Paul, so how do you read the broader state of the Mueller investigation? I mean, I look at this and I say, wow, the Manafort investigation was just much more advanced and forensically detailed than I expected. And in addition, he had this other complete surprise of a fully developed case. And that leads me to think that he's probably more advanced on a number of other fronts than we'd probably assumed by now. Does this make you think that there are other shoes dropping relatively quickly, or do you assume that this tells us nothing about where the rest of the investigation is?
Well, I would add, by the way, one of the great revelations to me was how much was being done before Mueller's appointment, because a lot of the stuff that relates to Manafort goes back into the pre-Mueller era. So that also suggests to me a reason to think that this investigation is further along than we suspected, because we now know that it was far from beginning from a standing start. It was Mueller taking over a relatively quick moving train. That having been said, I think it's a little hard to infer that all the other pieces are moving along as rapidly. In particular, some of them will be dependent upon factors outside of Mueller's control. One obvious example of that is whether or not Manafort elects to now cooperate with the investigation. And when he does so, he could do so tomorrow, he could do so on the eve of trial, or he could do so after conviction. And those are, very different time frames. This investigation won't be complete until Manafort's input is added to the mix. And the latest that that might happen might be after his conviction, when he's compelled to testify before a grand jury and has no Fifth Amendment with a grant of immunity that takes away his Fifth Amendment privilege, which could be a year from now.
The president's legal team has been, over the last few weeks, planting a bunch of stories about how they were anticipating that things were winding down and Mueller was going to sort of, by the end of the year, clear the president on obstruction. And they were facilitating all this document production to make this happen. And I'm wondering, in light of today, do you read that as simply delusional on the part of Ty Cobb, or is the investigation sufficiently compartmentalized that he may be actually pursuing a very reasonable strategy vis-a-vis the obstruction of justice stuff, and yet there's a bunch of ancillary matters related to campaign staff and whatnot, where there are some very, very serious issues? How do you read the posture of the president's legal team in light of this?
Well, I wouldn't say delusional, but I would say it's wishful thinking. You know, the average timeline for a white collar case of the size and scope of the one that has been brought against Manafort is a year. This case is not going to trial until the middle of next year at the earliest. And that means that it's quite likely that Manafort's participation in developing the facts of the investigation is unlikely to go forward before then. So unless you posit that Manafort has absolutely nothing to say about any of the obstruction of justice pieces, that part of the inquiry can't be closed out. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that Mueller doesn't know. And he won't know until he talks to Manafort, or at least tries to. So, you know, this seems to me to be a harbinger of a long-term strategy that is going to not result in a clearance of the president at the end of the year. And I think that Mr. Cobb's suggestion otherwise was more hope than reality.
So game this out from Manafort's point of view. I don't really understand how this reached the indictment stage, to be honest.
I don't either. I don't know why he didn't. Well, I have three possible reasons why he didn't go in and
beg for a deal.
The first is he might not have anything, right? Or not enough. I mean, it takes a lot of information to wash away $75 million in tax fraud, right? The second possibility is that he's banking on a pardon. So he doesn't need to run in and plead. The third possibility, which is very real, is that I've seen it in any number of people, is people in Mr. Manafort's position just can't believe that they're actually going to be charged and convicted. You know, they've had this experience all their lives that everything seems to break their way, and you know, their stature washes away a lot of flaws, and so they tend to think, you know, can't happen to me, not going to do it. I'm going to convince the jury if I just talk to them that I'm innocent, something like that. Psychological barriers to agreeing to plead guilty that are really strong in white collar defendants in ways that are different from what I've seen in blue collar defendants.
Okay, but there is a point, right, where he's got to know that he took a lot of steps to hide a lot of money, and he, in the back of his mind, he knows it's a lot of money, and he also knows that he was the chairman of the president's campaign, and therefore close enough. He was in the Trump Tower meeting with Vilnitskaya, and you know, he's got to know that he is a target with an enormous premium on him, and that he's got an enormous amount of exposure, and so at this point, what's the game theory of the relationship between him and Mueller's people, in which they presumably don't want to spend a year prosecuting him? He presumably doesn't want to do all the time associated with all the charges and all the nastiness that the sentencing guidelines could throw at him. So what's the mechanism by which they come together a little bit here?
Well, they have to try and find a deal. The problem for Mr. Manafort is, you know, the amount of his criminality is so great that it's going to be hard for Mueller to swallow it. I mean, what does Manafort want? He wants not to die in jail, right? If that's really his bottom line. Don't put me away for the rest of my born days. But he's a relatively old man. I think, what is he, like 68 or something like that? So yeah, a 10-year sentence is possibly a death sentence. And given what the charges are, it's hard to go too much lower than that without looking like you're buying testimony. Mueller has to keep the penalty at some reasonably high level, or it looks bad from his perspective.
As Paul is one of the relatively few people with experience conducting one of these high-profile investigations of the president, you are one of the relatively few people who has a working understanding of what it means to wake up in the morning and go into work to represent the president. And I'm just interested for your thoughts on what it means to be Don McGahn today and wake up and go into work and have this indictment come down and this plea agreement with this particular stipulation unsealed.
I see it from the perspective of the narrative that the president was trying to build. He was attempting to suggest that the Mueller operation was a witch hunt, that it was politically motivated. Lawyers in that office were political supporters of Hillary Clinton, and he was receiving some, not unanimous, Republican support over the weekend. And what strikes me about this Manafort indictment in particular is a straight down the fairway fraud court case, a clear-cut exercise in, you know, law enforcement on very, very traditional grounds, with, as you point out, significant detail in the indictment and a very, very clear thread to follow. And I think it's, to the extent that anything like this was needed on Mueller's part, and obviously there are many people who have followed Mueller over the course of his career and who don't believe he needed it, it is for the office, I think, a very, very important credibility bolstering move to protect him from these political attacks. So I think that first Manafort indictment, because it isn't political, has some large significance in the overall debate about this investigation and its duration and its direction.
And how do you read, if I were the president and I woke up this morning, or if I were Don McGahn and I woke up this morning and read the Papadopoulos stipulation, I would be very anxious, and I'm not sure if I'd be anxious primarily on legal grounds or primarily on political grounds, but, you know, one of the paragraphs of that document does specifically allege that the president was personally present, at a meeting at which Papadopoulos described his interactions with Russian officials and said there was an opportunity for, you know, for an engagement there. And so I'm wondering, if you're representing the president, how do you look at this situation now?
Without a question, of course, it being the second confirmed offer of support from Russian quarters for the campaign. I mean, it's significant on those grounds alone. It's significant in that, as Paul said earlier, it identifies some individuals who are certain to have to give testimony at some point. I also think it sends a fairly clear message. First of all, this is not a witch hunt in the sense that it's completely fabricated. This is a guilty plea. Now, granted, it's a guilty plea to a charge of failing to tell the truth to federal law enforcement officials. But that's another reason why I think this is an important first move by the Mueller office. It is a very clear signal in an investigation that is probably in its infancy that the people who are going to be asking questions about Russia expect truthful answers in return. And even somebody as marginal in some respects as perhaps his advisor seemed to be is going to pay a high price for the fudging that he did.
So, Bob, I want to follow up on your point about the narrative and the president's loss of control over the narrative. I mean, there was a very deliberate effort over the last week to condition the battlefield with suggestions of improprieties by Mueller and The Wall Street Journal suggested that he should resign. David Rifkin and Lee Casey today argued that the president should preemptively pardon everybody. I mean, there was a sort of a real press on this point. And I hear you saying that the seriousness of the allegations here are, you know, will push back against that, or at least should push back against that. And I'm interested in your sense of whether that's is that a hope, or is that a predictive analytical point, or is it both? Are, you know, as in, do you think this actually qualitatively changes the state of play, or are you merely as a hortatory matter saying that it should change the state of play?
Listen, any revelations that are seriously grounded should, just as a normative matter, change the state of play. It should squeeze the space for simply outright or crass politics. I think predictively, some of those who are on the fence with Trump and the GOP on these issues, who have thought of buying into this narrative or occasionally supporting it, are going to be spooked by cases like this that suggest that Mueller's running a very professional operation, that what he's putting forward is highly substantive, and there comes a point when the indefensible can't be defended. Now, we can all agree, you know, these individuals, Manafort in particular, has been indicted. Of course, Papadopoulos pled. Manafort has been indicted, and we don't know what defense he's going to tender. We all understand that he has an opportunity to make his case in court. But the indictment is one, I don't think, a Republican looking to help the president out with his political narrative is going to want to have to defend. He's not going to want to have to defend that, the proposition that this is politically cooked up in some way. So I predict that there's going to be a peeling off of otherwise, maybe willing or not so willing supporters of the president from the chorus that the president was trying to muster for an attack on Mueller. And I think that it's going to give some heartburn to, for example, you mentioned the Rivlins and the Caseys of this world and their Wall Street Journal editorial, who are arguing that these cases are inevitably politicized, these independent counsel arrangements pose huge risks, and therefore the outcome here should be left to the political process. It should be up to Congress to investigate. Well, these are not, in the first instance, on Manafort's part, the larger of the two cases released today. These are not, you know, political issues. These are outright, flagrant, multiple count violations of the law. That's up to the executive branch to pursue. And the argument that somehow this is a return to the politicization of independent counsels and something that's properly within the province of Congress has a lot less purchase today than I think the Republicans hoped over the weekend.
Do you agree with that, Paul?
Very much so. I mean, the idea of pardoning Manafort for what is essentially money laundering and tax fraud has a lot less appeal than would, say, pardoning Manafort for advice he gave in the context of the presidential campaign that could be spun as a witch hunt.
So, Bob, you know, the Papadopoulos stipulation is interesting for a lot of reasons, but one of the things that grabbed me about it is that there are actually two separate and, from my point of view, rather distinct operations that he was engaged in with respect to the Russians, one of which distasteful but peculiar, but I think in and of itself that's probably not all that objectionable, and the other of which much more troubling to me. So on the one hand, he's trying to set up a meeting between Trump and Putin, which I look at and I say, that's really distasteful because I hate Putin. But, you know, the idea that a presidential candidate would have profoundly different policy and foreign policy objectives than I do is not in and of itself a problem, and that he might want to meet with a leader whom I think is a war criminal and a snake is you know, kind of his prerogative. But the other thing that he's trying to do is trying to obtain emails that at least by the looks of it, are the hacked emails of the Clinton campaign and the DNC. And so I'm interested in your sense of kind of, are all things Papadopoulos created equal here? And just sort of, how should we think about this bifurcation?
It's a very good question. I think you're right. In normal circumstances, it's not unusual for a foreign government trying to decide which of the two major nominees is likely to confront in the White House to reach out and to try to learn more about them, create some contact that informs their thinking about the new administration. The problem here, which is why I don't think Papadopoulos or the campaign get by with that defense all that easily, is that it is so mixed up in the question of whether or not, over that same period of time, this relationship was starting to progress to poisonous proportions, that it was, in fact, not, though it might present in some emails that way, a mere meet and greet proposal. So, for example, Paul mentioned that in the middle of all of this, something helpful to the Republican position on Ukraine is inserted into the platform. Is that a pure Manafort play, or was there a general agreement that this was part of sort of an ongoing, off and on, sometimes direct, sometimes indirect dialogue with Russia? Obviously, that's an open question. And the fact that in this case, as in the lead up to the Trump Tower meeting, the approach that the Russians made was at least now twice confirmed, seasoned with an offer of campaign support, means that there was the reddest of flags up about what they might have had in mind. And it's not apparent that the campaign officials here thought they should stop at that point. They should treat this as something other than ordinary course. So on the face of it, one could say that piece of Papadopoulos' activity, bringing Russia together with the campaign, is something different than, for example, the Russian offer of help in securing these purloined emails. But the more you look into it, the more I think that that aspect of their defense weakens with each of these kinds of disclosures.
So I'm interested, Paul, in your sense of that. The thing to me that is the most shocking in the Papadopoulos discussion is that, you know, he describes these interactions in a fashion that, you know, at no time does anybody in the Trump campaign say, when they are hearing news of dirt in the form of these emails, no time does anyone say, wait a minute, the intelligence community has said that campaigns have been targeted. We have a foreign government saying they have access to thousands of emails. Should we report this to the FBI? Nobody seems to have paused for a moment to say that. And I'm curious for your thoughts both on what Bob said and also on that component of it.
Well, on the latter piece, on your component, I think that's actually expecting a bit of heroic understanding from everybody. I'm not sure that, you know, campaigns are quite that sensitive to it. They tend to see themselves mired in the battle of winning and losing, and to sometimes not notice when the line is crossed here. I agree with Bob very much that, you know, the change here from you know, wanting to meet the candidate to assess what he wants to, how the relationship might go forward, which is you know, distasteful, but you know, every campaign, every foreign government wants to meet every campaign about that. I can't tell you the number of times that people called me and asked about that when I was you know, working in the field myself. So, but it's the offer of assistance that is the actionable item, and it's the failure to recognize that it's a mistake that is going to be the comeuppance of the campaign people when the time comes. I'm dying to know who the campaign supervisor and senior campaign policy advisor are in the plea agreement and the statement of facts. They're the next people who need to look over their shoulder.
So speaking of people who aren't named, there is one person who is named in this indictment whom we haven't talked about at all, and that's Mr. Gates, Mr. Manafort's co-defendant. You know, what is he doing in there, and how do you read that, Paul?
Well, I mean, I think he's in there mostly because he was a major facilitator in the fraud, so he deserves to be there on grounds of criminality. But apparently, he also spent a fair amount of his time wrangling delegates for Trump, and he had some connection to the Trump campaign. So he is another potential person who might cooperate with the special counsel's office. And frankly, given that he's so much younger than Manafort, it seems to me like he has more to lose. So he might very well wind up being the unsung topic, subject of this inquiry.
Bob, final thoughts. What are you looking for to happen next?
Of course, in the world of the unexpected, I mean, it's sort of hard to say what I expect. I think that what we're seeing is the foundation of an investigation, and of course, I'm entirely speculating, that is going to be potentially a very extended one. I think that and again, I say this without, again, prejudging the outcome of any one of these indictments, but it is certainly going to have precisely the professional finish that everybody assumed it would have with the team that Mueller has assembled. And I think that the president's hope to marginalize him politically, as I've mentioned earlier, is should be dimming if he's thinking about it clearly. So I think that while many people expected this round, I think a lot of people, for a variety of reasons, because of press reports, thought something was coming down the pipe with Manafort. I don't know that they expected what Papadopoulos was going to do here, that he was going to plead to these offenses. And so I think that probably the best expectation at the moment is the entirely unexpected.
Paul, final thoughts. What are you looking for going forward?
Well, for starters, I think it's going to actually slow down a bit, right? We now have a criminal process going with respect to Manafort and Gates, and those things take time. There'll be discovery. There'll be motions work. Eventually, there may be discussions of pleas and proffers and cooperation. All that takes a lot of time. So that is, in that sense, it's going to slow down. In another sense, however, I think it's going to speed up, which is to say that given the manifest detail that Mueller has evinced in the Manafort indictment and the closeness of his investigation to real collusion that is shown in the Papadopoulos indictment, I actually am going to guess that far from taking heed of this and retrenching, the president, given his nature, is much more likely to double down, ramp up his attacks on Mueller, and make even more of an effort to discredit him, perhaps even resulting in an effort to fire him. That's my guess.
Bob Bauer, Paul Rosenzweig, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, but you know that, and we don't go through all this rigmarole on the special editions. So just go to iTunes, leave us that 5-star rating, and I promise I'll leave you alone. You know you count on us on days like this, because no one else can bring you Bob Bauer and Paul Rosenzweig to talk about the day's events. So just do what you know is right. Tweet about the Lawfare Podcast. Share it on Facebook. Bother your friends. They don't know about it yet, and they need to. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.